It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Darrell Conner. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, ever order your dinner on an app on your phone only to realize you've ordered a few more items than you usually would? Turns out that purchasing things with little to no cashier contact might have an effect on some of our spending habits. That's next.
First, a new investigative report finds that some Wisconsin National Guard units are failing to meet readiness requirements at a higher rate than units from neighboring Illinois and Iowa.
The news comes at a time when President Trump has called on National Guard members to go to the U.S.-Mexico border and to respond to various natural disasters.
Keegan Kyle is an investigative reporter for the USA Today Network Wisconsin. He's been following this story. Keegan, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, when we talk about readiness standards, it seems like there are different measures from state to state and in the nation. What kind of things are we talking about here?
Yeah, so in Wisconsin, they describe their readiness standards as a measurement looking at how often units are fully equipped, fully staffed, and fully trained to handle state and federal missions. In other states like Minnesota and Indiana, the numbers that we have look narrowly at medical readiness. So how often are soldiers healthy enough to respond? And then in other states like Iowa and Illinois, the numbers that we have available are a little bit more vague, but seem to align with Wisconsin, looking at kind of a general overview of how typically soldiers are able to handle missions.
And when we compare Wisconsin to our neighbors in Illinois and Iowa, where, as you were saying, they're kind of comparable measures, what do we find out?
Wisconsin numbers, the current snapshot, are lower than Illinois and Iowa, according to annual reports from those states and also annual reports from Wisconsin. So about a quarter of Wisconsin units are reportedly failing to meet readiness standards, whereas in Iowa and Illinois, the numbers are more in the 80% to 90% range.
And what have leaders of the Wisconsin National Guard said about these numbers and these comparisons?
The Wisconsin National Guard has said that the comparison is not fair because each state looks at its own local readiness needs as well as maybe federal readiness needs, and so the numbers don't exactly line up. They've also insisted that the Wisconsin National Guard, despite this statistical drop in its readiness, is fully capable of answering any calls that it needs to.
And you mentioned a statistical drop in readiness. What do we see when we look? You compared the numbers over time here in Wisconsin. What did you see?
So we looked at the numbers back to 2000, so more than 15 years. And almost every year, the readiness numbers are usually 100%. So 100% of units in the state are ready to respond to state or federal missions. But those numbers have gradually declined in the recent years, from 95% down to 82%, down now to 73%.
And what has the state's National Guard said about that decline in particular and why that might be?
Initially, their thought was that there's a nationwide shift in kind of defense strategy, and so they might be needing to do some new training to get up to those standards. They also suspected that a nationwide change in how the Army measures readiness might be influencing that drop as well. This week, we reported the Wisconsin National Guard shifted a little bit, and they more heavily blamed kind of a statistical change. So they themselves started measuring their readiness differently than they did years ago.
Talking to Keegan Kyle, investigative reporter for USA Today Network Wisconsin, about National Guard readiness in Wisconsin as compared to its neighbors. Rates are a little lower, at least according to one measure, how states measure themselves. And Keegan, you write that there are some federal standards and probably federal statistics on unit readiness. We, the public, and we, the press, don't get to see those numbers. Is that right?
Yes. So we've also talked with the National Guard authorities at the federal level about their readiness numbers and how they evaluate units across the entire country. And they have told us that those numbers are not public, and Wisconsin actually looks much better in those numbers, but that they are sensitive to national security, so we cannot see them.
And when it comes to state and what we can access as the public, I would think that each state would do things pretty similarly, but it sounds like, no, it's really radically different in some cases from one state's National Guard to another of how they measure themselves and how whether or not they release that data.
Exactly. So we also requested the same type of numbers for Ohio and Michigan, two other Midwest states. And Ohio required us to file a formal request, which remains pending. And Michigan didn't respond to our request at all. So public access to how readiness their own National Guard units are is very limited, and we're continuing to work on that.
Who is ultimately in charge for making sure Wisconsin's National Guard units are ready? Is it the National Guard themselves? Does the state government play a role? Who are the policymakers here?
Yeah, so the National Guard is more unique among military branches. It has a dual state and federal role. The governor of each state is the governor of Wisconsin is the commander-in-chief of the Wisconsin National Guard under the state constitution. But the Wisconsin National Guard gets most of its funding for training and equipment and a lot of other things through the federal government. So there's a lot of different fingers kind of in how the Wisconsin National Guard works.
And there are a lot of different things National Guard units can be deployed for. We've talked on this show about in the past about Wisconsin units serving overseas in places like Iraq and Afghanistan, or they can serve very close to home, filling sandbags for flooding. It seems like that might make it difficult to measure their readiness because there's so many different things they could be getting ready for, right?
Exactly. I think that's part of what the Wisconsin National Guard is saying, is that each state has different types of disasters that it typically responds to. They have different responsibilities in their own state, as well as they might be more positioned to help with federal missions or help in neighboring states as well. So that's kind of their point about, you know, comparing Wisconsin to other states can be very difficult. But again, there are actual national numbers that do that. We just don't have access to them.
And then with that number, the state's own assessment, about a quarter, as you said, of I think it was Army National Guard units didn't meet readiness standards. It doesn't sound like anybody you talked to was feeling any sense of panic or worry about this along the chain of command.
No, certainly not in the military. We did talk with some congressmen, so Speaker Paul Ryan's office, U.S. Representative Mike Gallagher, who both looked at these statistics and said it pointed to a nationwide need for additional defense spending. So they are concerned about where readiness stands today and believe that additional funding is required to help that.
You mentioned the Ohio numbers are still out there. Are there other measures of National Guard readiness that you are still in the search for as you report this story?
Yeah, we have some pending requests in other states with the federal government as well. And hopefully we might learn a little bit more about how the Wisconsin National Guard is performing, as well as units in other states.
Keegan, thanks as always for joining us.
Thanks so much.
Keegan Kyle is an investigative reporter for USA Today Network Wisconsin. He joins us today to talk about some Wisconsin National Guard units falling short of some of Wisconsin's current readiness requirements. Buy stuff without a cashier watching. Do our buying habits change? Shortly after Taco Bell launched their app in 2015, they reported the average digital order was 20% higher in cost than orders made with a cashier. And a liquor store that changed to a self-service option found that sales on products with hard-to-pronounce items increased by more than 8%.
Self-checkouts, kiosks, phone apps, with so many ways to buy a product without ever having to say a word to a human, how does that change what we buy?
We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What do you think about using self-checkouts at stores or ordering from a fast food restaurant, a kiosk, instead of from a cashier? Do you find that you buy different stuff, more stuff when checking yourself out? Maybe you're buying more junk food along the way. Do you like not having to talk to a cashier when you buy stuff? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Valerie Chandna is an assistant professor of management for the Austin E. Coffrin School of Business at UW Green Bay. She's joining us from our Green Bay studio. Valerie, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you.
Well, just anecdotally, this seems like a big trend. More and more I'm seeing self-checkouts and hearing about these kiosks and restaurants. Are you seeing that from where you're sitting?
Yes, that is very true. The numbers have been going up. Not as rapidly as was once predicted that, you know, you'd see them everywhere. We just stopped seeing cashiers completely. So it isn't that rapid a growth, but you are seeing them in more and more businesses that you wouldn't expect it at. So yes, there is definitely an upward trend there.
If I'm a store owner, what's in it for me? Is it just that I can pay the robot less than I pay my employee?
You can definitely pay the robot less than your employee. It comes down to cents as compared to dollars. So there is definitely that difference there. And like you mentioned, there's definitely been research that says that the consumption levels increase. The amount spent by people goes up per receipt. You also see them buy unusual items that they may not have otherwise. You'll also see people come to your store that otherwise may not have. So say I have the Walmart pickup grocery app. I was just speaking to someone about that. So instead of going to a store I usually did, Walmart has this cool app that allows me to order stuff and pick it up there. Now I'll go back to Walmart, who I hadn't seen, you know, in 4 years. I'd never gone there. So there is a shift in which stores I might go to or which businesses I might frequent as well.
So there's some weird consumer psychology going on here if I'm buying more stuff or weirder stuff without, what, the judgmental eye of the cashier casting, you know, aspersions on me?
Yep, that's exactly what it is, because no one's looking at what I'm buying. Somehow I forget that they're still packaging it for me. But yeah, there is part of that where, well, and the other thing that actually happens is that the machine always remembers to upsell, right? So if it's a cashier, I might not feel comfortable, or I may forget to say, oh, do you also want, you know, X, Y, and Z item to go with that? But if it's the machine will remember to prompt you to buy, in fact, three other items. Like, I don't think I've ever ordered pizza without being reminded about dessert and like 10 different sides. So, you know, they're throwing the temptation towards your way very frequently through those kiosks and apps.
How much of this is happening because a store or restaurant isn't just competing with other stores and restaurants, they're competing with online options, in particular for stores with Amazon?
I think some of it is that they don't want to be left behind. So they are trying to make that trend where, yes, everyone is used to using their screens, looking at their screens and ordering. So, yes, we don't want to be left behind. And I think the restaurants, to some extent, that was the idea behind it, that there wasn't as much purpose to it initially. You could just pay your check. That was all you could do. But now it's like, okay, people like playing on the screen until the server gets there. They can order their drinks ahead of time. Since people are used to the screens and are used to the online sort of component, businesses feel compelled to introduce it to their stores as well.
Well, I want to take this into a point of where there's been some friction, the grocery store self-checkout and the famous unauthorized item in bagging area sort of thing. A lot of customers, I'll speak for myself, I am very annoyed when I've been through this experience. I'll avoid it as much as I possibly can.
And that is true. I think different industries lend themselves to having the self-service be more popular versus others. So I definitely agree. I'm completely with you with the grocery store thing. I really don't feel I need to do this work. I've already worked hard at picking out the groceries. But at that point, now I need someone to check me out.
Well, I was looking back at some grocery history, and once upon a time, you went into a store, you told the attendant what you wanted, they went and gathered it for you, and it was this really newfangled invention that the customer walked around and did that labor. So we get used to this stuff after a while, I guess.
Oh, my gosh. And I guess in a few years, we'll be saying, oh, self-service. Remember when we had to go to a cashier to get ourselves checked out? I remember those days. But, yeah, and the other industry I think that's, you know, you don't enjoy the self-service as much in is the airline industry. You know, you have to go there. You have to check yourself in. You still have to go drop off the bags. So I don't see they're saving a lot of money, but I think the work increases for the customer in airlines and groceries. It's a lot more work for the customer.
I want to bring in a caller now at 800-642-1234. Eric is with us in Madison. Eric, hi, what do you think?
Hey, you know, actually, I go out of my way to go to a cashier. I you know, one of the things that bothers me is the more self-check stations I see, the fewer workers that I actually see. And, you know, I mean, I guess my point is I think there's an opportunity to employ folks, you know, in the grocery stores, but by automating a lot of the checkout services, you know, those are jobs that people could actually use.
Eric, thanks a lot for the call. Can you talk about how this affects employment, Valerie? Because, yeah, there's one cashier and a bagger working in a checkout aisle. Self-check, there's one cashier attending to four of those often.
Yes, and that's really true. I mean, a lot of companies, you know, they're making it sound like it's for our convenience, but really it's to reduce costs and employ less people. And that is something I think raises an ethical question where companies need to think about, yes, of course, legally, there's no restriction on me putting in kiosks and things like that, but I should think about this more ethically. Am I reducing, you know, potential employment for people? So there's definitely that issue for sure.
Eric, thanks for that call. We're talking to Valerie Chandna from UW Green Bay, talking about how self-checkout aisles are changing consumer behavior. And speaking of ethical issues, Valerie, some research seems to suggest that if we check ourselves out, we're maybe more likely to steal stuff. And you know, maybe we could play it off. People say, oh, I just accidentally, I thought I scanned it.
I know. I think there's we throw too much temptation in the way of people saying, well, you know, they start feeling like, oh, I'm putting in all this effort. If I took one item, who cares? Or, oh, it's this huge, you know, conglomerate or faceless entity I'm stealing from, because you're not interacting with a human person. It's the annoying machine, for example, that's telling you there's an unidentified item in the bagging area. So now you're mad at the machine and, you know, there's so many reasons that you don't feel as guilty about the shoplifting. Let's put it that way.
Well, now let's look at the future a little bit. People are developing technology, Amazon again and others, where you walk into a store, you just pick stuff up, put it in a bag, put it in your pockets. It scans it on the way out. It may scan your credit card or your face is something it might scan in the future and just charges you as you walk out the door.
Yes, those are the Amazon Go stores. Sorry about that. And yes, you're completely right. They've got, you know, endless cameras focused in the store. They've got a lot of different kind of machines and scanners. I believe there's some sort of RFID and infrared technologies also involved in that. So as you walk the store, it's basically keeping track of your items. The carts you use also have some weight and other identifying sensors on it. So they're able to keep track of everything you're shopping. And Amazon, I think after the launch, said that it does not err on the side of overcharging. The only thing that might happen is undercharging. So they might forget to bill you for an item, but you'd never be overcharged. So I found that was pretty interesting. And there are a lot of other businesses trying to get a hold of this technology as well.
Let's bring on another caller now. Nancy is with us in Madison. Nancy, hi. What do you think about this?
Well, I want no part of self-checking out. Since I'm 84 years old, I want the relationships. I want to interact with people. And it's interesting when you do at cash registers, if you're working with a young person, many times they don't know how to talk and interact. But the older people do, who are working those positions, and there is interaction. I myself am opposed to any of this self-checking.
Nancy, thanks a lot for that call. And Valerie, yeah, we're really inventing a society where we don't need to interact with people very much. This is taking out some of the few interactions we might have on a daily basis.
I completely agree. I mean, the human interaction component is very much reduced with all of these things. The example that you were talking about just now, the Amazon Go stores, you literally don't have to interact with anyone, which becomes pretty fascinating as a phenomenon. I mean, you don't need to like the phenomenon, of course, but it's just interesting that this can happen. But yes, definitely, there are a lot of purchasers who make that extra effort to, you know, want to go talk to a cashier. They'll ask for help in stores because it's more fun that way. You know, it's a social experience.
Thanks a lot for that call, Nancy. Of course, a lot of people, more and more people, are not even leaving their house to do their shopping now, with buying on mainly Amazon and other websites. Does it really matter what's happening in stores if we're just moving to this digital buy it at home anyway future?
I think that's interesting. I was just thinking about myself, whereas I do a lot of my shopping online, to be honest. And I enjoy that component because it gives me the flexibility of doing research, comparing prices, knowing that I'm finding, you know, the best possible deal. It's coming to me in the most efficient manner. Sometimes there are components of it where, you know, the weather is a certain way and you're like, well, shopping online is just easier, especially for us in Wisconsin. And I lived in Texas, so a few years ago in the summer, I did not want to get out of my house. So I was just happy that the packages magically appeared. So yes, I agree. That is interesting that the stores, they're kind of trying to keep up with what's happening anyway. They know people are shopping online. People love the convenience. Large populations of people love the convenience. So they're trying to just stay in the game, I think.
I've seen another case that, hey, maybe the retail strategy to compete with Amazon is to make your store, and this maybe only fits certain types of boutique stores, I don't know, but to make your store an experience. It is a cool thing to go out and leave your house and do. It seems like if we're moving away from cashiers, going to these automatic checkouts, we're not really trying to do that. We're just trying to get people in and out as fast as possible.
Right. And I think what you're saying is very interesting, because going to the stores being an experience, some stores are trying to make it an Instagrammable moment. Like their walls that are well painted, their chairs that are cool looking. So you want to Instagram it. So you can only do that, you know, if you're in the store. So that's how they're attracting you. I think that the major switch with the cashless or the kiosks needs to be looked at and said, does this work in my industry or not? And I think some businesses will have to rethink it eventually.
Do you expect to see, it may be industry by industry, but do you expect to see more cashierless, interactionless experiences in our shopping in the coming years?
I think it is definitely going to go up unless there is some major change or switch that sort of where businesses are also having to pay a sort of a tax on utilizing this whenever they, you know, let go of human employment. If there is sort of that, you know, additional fee or charge at automation, that might make them think twice. But other than that, I do not see this trend going down.
Valerie, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
That was Valerie Chandna, Assistant Professor of Management at the University of Wisconsin, Green Bay. She joined us to talk about how self-checkout lanes and restaurant kiosks are affecting consumer behavior.
The days may be numbered for one of the nation's most prominent conservative magazines, The Weekly Standard.
Its owner, Clarity Media, recently announced that a sister publication, The Washington Examiner, would be rolling out a new weekly conservative magazine with national distribution. In a statement, the company said it's, quote, exploring a number of possibilities, end quote, for the Standard's future. In addition, Politico is reporting that an all-hands meeting is scheduled for tomorrow. They quoted an unnamed Weekly Standard writer as saying the assumption is that, quote, something bad is going to happen on Friday.
The Weekly Standard came on the scene in 1995 and has generally supported Republicans, but it's been opposed to President Trump, putting it at odds with many of its readers.
Charlie Sykes is a contributing editor to The Weekly Standard, author of How the Right Lost Its Mind, and a former longtime talk radio host in Milwaukee. Charlie, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Good to be with you.
Well, you've been involved with the Weekly Standard. Now, what was your reaction when you started hearing this latest news about the Weekly Standard?
Well, it's highly unfortunate because the Weekly Standard has been, I think, one of the most important and interesting and innovative voices among conservatives. You know, not just in its skepticism and opposition to President Trump, but really as a thoughtful outlet for conservative writers on culture, on a lot of the issues of the day. So I think it would be a significant loss if, in fact, it disappears.
Now, we've seen, according to Politico, the Weekly Standard circulation has gone down over the last couple of years, especially since President Trump has taken office. Now, I know weekly political magazines, it's not what you do to make tons of money, right? There's a lot of challenges for the industry as a whole. But did the arrival of President Trump on the scene add extra difficulties to the Weekly Standard?
Yeah, certainly. There's no question about it. I mean, you've seen this with the shift on the right. As Republicans and conservatives have rallied around Donald Trump, which, of course, you know, creates a problem for conservatives who want to say, you know, hey, let's hold off on the cult of personality here. I've argued that it's very difficult to find a successful business model to be an anti-Trump conservative. Now, so yes, there's no question that has created headwinds. But having said that, the Weekly Standard was still, you know, by the standards of weekly political magazines, still doing quite well. What I think is about to happen is really not a natural death as opposed to a choice by the ownership.
Right. I know you can't read the ownership's minds there, But do you think that this potential end to the weekly standard is because of the magazine's opposition to President Trump?
Well, I certainly don't want to exaggerate my insight into all the things that are going on behind the scenes. I'm not in Washington. I'm still in Milwaukee. So I think there's probably a lot of issues that are going on, but there's no question about it that that is a significant factor in what's going on, that you have two publications side by side, the Washington Examiner and the Weekly Standard. The Washington Examiner has been, shall we say, much more Trump-friendly and open to Trumpian ideas, and including some folks on the right that would not ever be published in the Weekly Standard. So what the ownership has decided to do is shift tremendous resources into the Washington Examiner, turn that into a magazine, at the same time that they are very, very likely to kill off the Weekly Standard. So you have the death of one of the more independent Trump skeptical publications and a substantial expansion of a publication that has been much, much friendlier to Donald Trump.
Talking to Charlie Sykes, contributing editor to the Weekly Standard, longtime radio host in Milwaukee, talking about what looks like the likely end of the Weekly Standard. And Charlie, you mentioned this isn't the only thing it's ever done, but the Weekly Standard has been notable for its voice as a conservative but non-necessarily Trump-supporting outlet. Why is it important for you and others to have this form, this version of conservatism kept alive and popularized?
Well, because I don't think that Donald Trump represents all of conservatives. I mean, clearly right now, most conservatives have decided to make their peace with him, have decided to modify their standards in order to support Donald Trump. But there's another tradition there, and I think it's a tradition that we saw during the funeral for George H.W. Bush, when we began to think about what John McCain represented in American politics. So it's important always, I think, to have a forum for ideas that are not completely tribal. And one of the things that Steve Hayes, who's the editor-in-chief, and I have talked about, I host their daily podcast, is we wanted to create a voice that was smart, non-tribal, and conservative. But the hard part is the non-tribal, because so much of our politics is tribal. And every once in a while, I think it's important to go back and say, look, we don't necessarily have to buy this untruth. We don't have to buy these extreme comments. Let's be honest about the nature of this administration. Some of the strongest articles that were written in the Weekly Standard came after the president's comments after Charlottesville, where he referred to, after the neo-Nazi march in Charlottesville, referred to, good people on both sides. And the Weekly Standard was one of the few and most eloquent conservative voices saying, no, that is not true. That's not where we stand. That's not who we are.
A lot of conservatives and Republicans might say, okay, a lot of that stuff, the president's tweets, a lot of things he says, set that aside. We're getting a lot of traditional conservative Republican agenda items checked off. Judges to the Supreme Court that probably a President Rubio or President Cruz would have been happy to appoint. Lower court judges mostly along the same lines. A big tax cut, regulatory changes. The outcome, is it really that much different than another conservative Republican president might have been?
No, and you've made the case well, and that, of course, is one of the debates that's going on in the conservative movement. And there are writers and articles that have been written in the Weekly Standard that have made roughly those points. But then there's also the question, what is the price tag for all of that? What are we willing to accept? What are we willing to give up? How much of the president's character and his judgment are we willing to excuse in order to get that? And I've compared this to the Faustian bargain, where in a Faustian bargain, you get what you want. You get a lot of good things, only to find out that the price, in this case your soul, is much greater than you had perhaps anticipated. And I think that the Republican Party is really struggling through that Faustian bargain with Donald Trump, and with every day they're finding out that the price goes up.
Talk about that price a little more. What part of the conservative soul do you see people losing?
Well, I think in part of it, it's the way in which they've become a prisoner to Donald Trump's mendacity, to his lies. The president has created this swamp of corruption and deceit around his presidency, and there are a lot of Republicans that feel that, well, as long as we get tax cuts, we're not going to speak out against that. We're going to look the other way. as the president, lashes out, demeans his opponents, mocks the disabled and women, and all of those things. And, of course, the Republican Party is paying a price for that at the polls. But it continually shifts the window of what they are willing to accept. Look, I'll be honest with you. I was one of those that spent 20 years trying to say that a lot of the criticism of the right, you guys are racist and sexist and, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, xenophobic. And I, thought, no, there's a different tradition. There's, the Jack Kemps of the world, the Paul Ryans of the world. But what's happening is now that Donald Trump comes up and he's sort of a caricature of all of those things. And you're seeing conservatives basically either embracing it or being willing to accept it. And I think this is just a long-term political disaster, but I think also it's a moral test that they're failed.
Now, you saw yourself as a radio host. You've talked about how a lot of your listeners bought into what Donald Trump was selling as a candidate. What does that mean? Does that mean that Donald Trump changed the conservatives who are already there, or that the things he represented were there and maybe not recognized as much, even by people within the party?
Well, that's a fascinating question. And you'll recall that in Wisconsin, Wisconsin conservatives were very Trump skeptical, very, very opposed to him through the middle of 2016. This was the one state where he hit a massive speed bump, the Wisconsin presidential primary by double digits. But as the year went on, you saw the tribalization of American politics kick in and people deciding, okay, even though we might have thought he was completely unfit for this office and were repelled by some of the things that he said, we're going to go along with him because no matter how awful he is, Hillary Clinton must be worse, and it's a binary choice. So one of the things that I've asked is what was out there, what was the pre-existing condition that enabled people to look at Donald Trump and say, yeah, that's okay, we're willing to accept that. And I think there's a lot of introspection and debate going on about what was really happening on the right that perhaps we did not fully understand, that we perhaps were naive or blinded ourselves to, that it was willing to accept this. And certainly, race has been one of the hot point buttons that that we have debated internally. The question, I don't know what proportion of conservatives might be, have racial bias, but what we're seeing is the willingness of so many to at least find it acceptable or to be indifferent to the playing of the race card, which is really disturbing to many of us. And a lot of us have to look back and go, did we contribute to this, or were we willfully blind to a lot of this that was happening?
We're talking about the future of the Weekly Standard and what its possible end could mean for conservative media and politics. Charlie Sykes is with us, contributing editor to the Weekly Standard, author of How the Right Lost Its Mind, and a longtime talk radio host in Milwaukee.
Let's hear from you at 800-642-1234. What's your reaction to the potential downfall of the Weekly Standard? Do you read the Standard, or are you turned off by its opposition to President Trump? Do you feel like there's no room for the Never Trump voice on the right? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or tweet us at Central Time, WPR.
We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. We're talking about the Weekly Standard's uncertain future with Charlie Sykes. He's a contributing editor to that magazine. He's worried that there may not be room in the conservative media landscape for conservatives who don't back Donald Trump. He's also the author of How the Right Lost Its Mind and a longtime radio host in Milwaukee.
You can join us at 800-642-1234. Are you or have you been a fan of the Weekly Standard, or is it too anti-Trump for your taste? What do you think its loss would mean for conservative media? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or tweet us at Central Time, WPR.
And Charlie, you've mentioned political tribalism some. Talk about what you mean by that. Is it the sense that a thing is wrong only if the other side does it? If our people do it, we can kind of overlook that.
Well, that's exactly right. And we're seeing that played out, and we'll see it played out next year, where both sides have adopted this the moral relativism of picking and choosing what their standards are. But also, I think one of the mistakes that a lot of us made in politics, and I've talked about this a lot, has been to think that politics was primarily about ideas or about policies or even about accomplishments, when in fact this new tribal politics is more like about identity. It's about attitude. It's about our side winning, the other side losing. And if that means absolutely flip-flopping on the, you know, positions like, for example, whether personal character and honesty matters, then people are completely willing to do that.
Let's bring on a caller now. Dick is with us in Madison. Hi.
Yeah, I find this kind of fascinating. I told your screener I basically disagreed with most of what was in it. I'll come right out front and say that. But in the last 2 years, I've really read it, and what he was saying earlier, I agree with. They were the only people, you know, from the right that were challenging this person. And, you know, and the other thing is there's other stuff in the magazine that's interesting. You know, little side notes, sports stuff, periodically. And it's kind of fascinating that something, you're talking about something even harder right, is going to stand up along the lat last, you know.
All right. Thanks a lot for the call. Charlie, I think a lot of people, maybe from the center, left, Democrats, whatever you want to call it, gain a newfound admiration for the Weekly Standard in the last couple of years.
I think that that's true. And it is. I'll be honest. I mean, I'm biased. I have a conflict of interest, but it's an outstanding publication with great writers. Stephen Hayes and Bill Kristol assembled really an all-star cast of columnists, of people who wrote personality profiles. So, yes, it has been an important voice. But also, what really has impressed me is the moral courage of the editors and the writers who've continued to go against the tide. It is not easy for conservatives to be anti-Trump these days. And I don't think you can underestimate the pressure on people in the conservative media to sort of, you know, bow the knee, to go along. And they have not done that. They've refused to do that. And I have, you know, I'm tremendously proud of them and proud to be associated with them. And I think they deserve a lot of credit.
Thanks a lot for that call. Going out to Jeff with us in Superior. Jeff, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'll try to keep it short. I'm first of all shocked that Wisconsin Public Radio is even bringing up this topic. But I'm glad that you are, and I'm grateful. So I went to Trump's rally when he was in Superior. He flew into the airport in Duluth, and we had a rally of about 5,000 people in Superior in April of 2016. And that really coalesced a lot of people in this area for his campaign. So what it did, it highlighted, at least in this part of northern Wisconsin, that there was a split in the Republican Party. You had Walker Republicans, and you had Trump Republicans. Now, when it came to the winning, the Wisconsin primary, Cruz won the primary, but there were still a lot of Trump supporters, and that's why I think Trump won Wisconsin. The reason I'm bringing this up is I declared my candidacy for the assembly in November of 2016, but I didn't get any help from the Republican Party because I've supported Trump. And there were a lot of Walker Republicans, and they're loyal to Walker and all that, blah, 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 but Walker lost, you know. And Trump won. So in my opinion, the whole party loyalty thing speaks to how to be effective as leaders and how to be, effective in terms of government once you actually gain power. So,
Jeff, thanks a lot for the call. I want to bring Charlie in on this interesting perspective there, Charlie.
Well, yeah, I mean, but understand that Donald Trump won because the Republican establishment in Wisconsin rallied around him, despite all of their qualms. Scott Walker, who ran for president himself, supported Donald Trump. Reince Priebus, who was at that time the chairman of the Republican National Committee, made winning Wisconsin a priority there. But I do think this is the power of party loyalty. But that doesn't mean that you ought not to have strong voices saying, here's an alternative vision. Because I think long-term, Trumpism is going, you know, we don't know whether it's going to end in tragedy or farce, but I personally think it's going to end very, very badly. And a lot of Republicans, you know, at the end of this period, the day after Donald Trump leaves, are going to try to, you know, say to, you know, women and minorities and young people, that wasn't us. We weren't really part of that, but they were. And right now they are owning, you know, that agenda, that style, and the moral, character that he's presenting. So I think it's crucial from the conservative point of view to have an alternative voice, Not to mention that I think it's healthy in this society to have an articulate, intelligent, center-right voice that, in fact, can perhaps continue this discussion across some of these tribal divides. And I think that up until today, the Weekly Standard was able to do that. I mean, whatever's going to happen, it will happen tomorrow. So I said today, but today feels like it's one of the final days.
Jeff, thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to Charlie Sykes about the likely end of the Weekly Standard and the place of Never Trump, so-called Never Trump conservatives in the conservative political and media landscape. And Charlie, I do want to switch gears. You've written about something a little closer to home here in Wisconsin, the extraordinary session of the legislature, the pieces of legislation that Governor Walker is likely to sign, it looks like, in the next 6 days. Your thoughts on the changes made there?
Well, I wrote a piece not for the Weekly Standard, but for the Atlantic last week. So, you know, it's essentially urging Scott Walker not to sign all of that because, you know, even though some of the rhetoric has been over the top about the end of democracy, the death of democracy, the reality is that what the legislature did in this last minute lame duck session was petty, it was vindictive, and it's likely to backfire on Republicans. And I think it will tarnish Scott Walker's legacy. And he's been tweeting since then. He's been on sort of a tweet storm saying, "No, here's my legacy, here's what I've accomplished." And my point would be then make sure that you don't step on that you don't basically change the subject from that to this last minute. There's no other way to feel than that it is vindictive, stripping the power from the man who beat you for governor and from the incoming attorney general. It looks like sour grapes because it is sour grapes. The other point I tried to make in that Atlantic article was that ultimately you don't get much for it. This is not the end of the world. Some of the claims about it are exaggerated, but this is another reason for Walker not to sign it, that it really doesn't make that much of a difference. So you are creating this national firestorm. You are endangering your legacy. You're really hurting yourself and the image of the Republican Party of Wisconsin. For what? For very, you know, really, essentially, more or less minor things, with the exception of the attack on early voting, which I think is also going to end up probably being thrown out by a federal court.
In our last minute, Charlie, can we overcome political tribalism here in Wisconsin? Do you see Republican lawmakers and an incoming Democratic governor actually getting stuff done?
Well, they're going to have to get some stuff done. They're going to have to figure out a way to do that. How that's going to happen is hard to imagine. Similar in Washington, D.C., when you have divided government, sooner or later you're going to have to compromise. And every time you take a step like this, you make it that much more difficult. I think one of the things in our tribal politics that we've seen is that compromise has become a dirty word, and somehow we need to overcome that.
And very briefly, do you see Scott Walker making another chapter in his political life? Will we have Scott Walker to kick around again, to quote Richard Nixon?
There's always another chapter for Scott Walker. Look, he's 51 years old. In theory, he could be around for, you know, politically active for another 30 years. I don't think he's leaving the state anytime soon. So, yes, I think you will have Scott Walker to kick around more.
Charlie, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, it's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Charlie Sykes is a contributing editor to the Weekly Standard, author of the book How the Right Lost Its Mind, and a former longtime talk radio host in Milwaukee. We've been talking with him about a variety of things, starting with the possible end of the conservative weekly, the Weekly Standard, and what that means about the place of conservatives skeptical about Donald Trump, whether they have a place in conservative politics and the media landscape. That's Janet Jackson. Miss Jackson, if you're nasty.
She is in the news today as one of the 7 new inductees in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. The other new members are Radiohead, The Cure, Def Leppard, Roxy Music, and the Zombies.
And Stevie Nicks technically re-enters the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. She had already been inducted as a member of Fleetwood Mac, and this year she's in as a solo performer.
The nominees who didn't make it this year were Devo, John Prine, Kraftwerk, LL Cool J, MC5, Rage Against the Machine, Rufus featuring Chaka Khan, and Todd Rundgren.
You had thoughts on this earlier, Drell, on LL Cool J for one.
I did. I thought that since Grandmaster Flash and the Furious Five, Run DMC, the Beastie Boys, and Tupac are in, I figured that LL Cool J would be in by now because he was one of the founding members of Def Jam and truly a pioneer.
And also a Kraftwerk.
Yes, I thought Kraftwerk should have gotten in, too, because of the fact that they influenced so much of the techno-hip-hop movement, the Afrika Bambaataa, Soul Sonic Force, and so many others. I thought it was a missed opportunity, but, of course, you know, they still have chances to get in. So.
They do. Here's one of the bands that waited longest, the Zombies, here at Central Time.
Well, no one told me about how many people cried. But it's too late to say you're sorry.